This is program number 11 of the Does God Exist audio series. John Clayton is your speaker. I hope that as you listen to program number 11, you have listened, first of all, to program number 10. Because in program number 10, we have introduced the question of which God? Why Jesus Christ? Why not Muhammad? Why not Buddha? Why not Zoroaster? Why not Baha'u'llah? Why Jesus Christ? And I would like to emphasize again, this isn't a matter of being intolerant. This is a matter of understanding what evidence there is for the position to which we hold. I would be intolerant if I would not allow someone else to express their ideas. I would be intolerant if someone were to do violence to me because of my beliefs, or I was to do violence to them because of their beliefs. And I would defend with my life the right of a Muslim or a Hindu or a Buddhist to express why they believe the system they believe, but I would disagree with them. In our last presentation, we looked at internal evidence that the Bible, in fact, is different than other religious manuscripts. Internal evidence that, in fact, there is a truth in the Bible that is not found in the Vedas or the Quran or the sayings of Buddha. And I would encourage you, if you haven't done so, to examine that evidence. I would encourage you to not take my word for it, but to get a copy of the Quran, a copy of the Vedas. They're available in your local library. You can purchase them online for less than $2 each and take a look at them. But it isn't just internal evidence. The Bible has checkability that I don't believe you find in other religious manuscripts. Now, by checkability, that's a Clayton term. That's not a biblical term or a scientific term. It just means the ability to check what is said and see if it's true or not. And there are so many areas in which this can be done. Scientifically, you can demonstrate the checkability. Way back in 1970, in the December issue of Natural History magazine, there was an article called Punching Through to Heaven, written by Franklin Branly of Princeton University. The article was a survey of what ancient cultures believed about the celestial sphere. There were drawings and pictures made by an artist by the name of Helmut Wimmer. And those drawings are so good that to this day they are frequently seen in planetariums because they depict what ancients understood about space, about the sky, and about what the Earth's relationship is to the sky. And the article that was written by Franklin Branly has appeared in many different forms in many different places. When I was in college, we were studying in a comparative religion class belief systems of religion, and one of the first ones we studied in that class was the beliefs of the Babylonians. The Babylonians, and this is in Franklin Branly's article, had the concept that the earth is in something that would resemble a plastic hemisphere. The stars and the planets were attached to the hemisphere. And the sun was a ball of fire pushed across the sky each day by a giant beetle to a house. Now, it's important to understand here that people who teach comparative religions will usually say that the Babylonian concept was copied by biblical writers, by other writers. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting that because of the similarity in flood tablets of the Babylonians, many people assume that some of the things that you see in the Bible were actually just blatant copies of Babylonian tradition. The Egyptian writings do reflect a connection with this Babylonian concept. Everything was pretty much similar, except that the chariot of fire driven by the sun god Ra was used to explain the presence of the sun. Remember the Pharaoh's name? Ramesses. When you take a look at the concept of the Hindus, the earth was viewed as being on the back of four elephants. And that makes really good sense. I want to emphasize that I'm not attempting to denigrate these explanations. They're very logical. They make good sense. Elephants are strong. They're a symbol of strength. And to whatever extent you interpret this as being a literal physical description, it's useful. The four elephants were standing on a turtle who's swimming in a sea of milk. Why does everything move across the sky very, very slowly? Turtles are slow. And the sea of milk, of course, is also great symbolic value. The Japanese had the earth on the back of a giant catfish. And what are they explaining? They're explaining tsunamis. Branly gives a beautiful description of how logical and how carefully those concepts were put together. The Greeks had the earth on the shoulders of a man by the name of Atlas, and some of you may remember that there are pictures of Atlas holding up the earth. Every culture we know anything about has some kind of a physical support system to the earth. Some of them involved a walled box floating in the sky, such as the Chaldean concept. But it's important to understand that there is one exception to that. And that is that nowhere in the Bible is there an indication that the earth is physically supported. As a matter of fact, the only time you see any kind of a reference like this is in symbolic or poetic passages, like Job 26:7, and even there it says, "He stretcheth out the north over the empty space, and hangeth the earth upon nothing." It's kind of interesting to realize that there are numerous scientific statements, astronomical statements, made throughout the Bible. And I want to emphasize something. I'm not suggesting to you that the Bible writer sat down and said, okay, let's reveal some science. No. That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that when something is stated in the Bible that can be checked scientifically, it always turns out to be right. Let me give you an example of this. In Luke 17, we have an example where there's an event taking place that really does not have, at least not primarily, scientific implications. Luke 17, beginning with verse 31, says, "In that day," so it's a daytime activity, "he which shall be upon the housetop and his stuff in the house, let him not come down to take it away. And he that is in the field, let him likewise not return back." So people are in the field, people are working on the housetop. Those are daytime activities. But as you keep reading, in verse 34, he goes on and says, regarding the same event, "I tell you, in that night, there shall be two men in one bed. One shall be taken, the other shall be left." And then the very next verse, in verse 35, says that there will be two women grinding grain together. One will be taken, the other shall be left. Two men shall be in the field, the one shall be taken, the other left. So verse 34 says nighttime gives nighttime activities. Verse 35 and 36 give daytime activities. What did the author of this information have to understand for the statements to be anything other than self-contradictory idiocy? I suggest to you they had to understand that daytime and nighttime occur at the same time. That's not the purpose. That's not the intent. But it is interesting that that is stated in that way. In the field of medicine, there are statements throughout the Old Testament that have only been proven in recent times. The fact that blood is essential to life in Leviticus 17, beginning in verse 11 through verse 14, was certainly not understood at that time. The fact that woman possesses a quote-unquote seed in Genesis 3:15 and Genesis 22:18 certainly was not known until recently. The fact that eating blood is dangerous in Leviticus 17, beginning with verse 12, certainly was not understood at that time. The fact that circumcision could be done after 8 days in Genesis 17:12 because of the clotting mechanism, which we now understand, was a very wise practice in which to do that. And by the way, even the process of circumcision, which has been widely debated in modern years, is now known to be a very beneficial thing. There's a correlation between not having circumcision and HIV as a contracted disease. The burial of waste in Deuteronomy 23, beginning with verse 12. In the physical sciences, we have statements that have only been discovered in recent time. The fact that lightning is produced by rain, not Zeus throwing bolts in anger. Jeremiah 10 and verse 13, Jeremiah 51 and verse 16. You can go through dozens and dozens and dozens of statements in the Bible that are of scientific nature. And if you're interested, you can write me. I can send you a printed copy of that. I also can send you a printed copy of statements in the Quran, which are clearly not true scientifically. The idea that honey comes out of the bee's abdomen and heals man in Surah 16, verse 69, is not correct. There are numerous references to things in the sky, that a shooting star is a weapon of God used to strike devils, for example, in Surah 37, 6. Again, I can send you a list of those. I would encourage you to get a Quran and look it up. See for yourself. Even in the Book of Mormon, there are statements that can be checked to see whether they're scientifically correct or not. The one I really object to, because I am very bald, is 2 Nephi 13, beginning with verse 24, which says that baldness is caused by sin. But maybe I better not pursue that. Someone might suggest that that really is probably accurate, and even though I don't think it is, I can understand why the claim might be made. The fact is, there are numerous statements in the Book of Mormon that are not scientifically correct. So make a comparison. The last point I'd like to make is, yeah, there's checkability. And I just looked a little bit at some of the scientific areas. We could talk about psychology. We could talk about history. We could talk about any number of areas. But perhaps one of the most significant things that we could discuss as far as evidence of inspiration is what I call system design. By system design, I mean when something works, there's always an intelligence, a purpose, a reason why the thing works. And if you'll compare the Bible with other systems, other religious systems, I think you can see the superiority of the Bible. In Natural History Magazine, there was an article some years ago which showed the structure of the Hindu society. National Geographic, in the January issue of 2011, had an interesting article in the same. In Hindu society, the priests are at the top of a caste system. Under them are the warriors. Under them are the merchants. And at the very bottom of Hindu society are the untouchables. You are born into one of those castes, and you cannot change where you were born. If you're born an untouchable, you can't go to school. You can't be an artist. You can't be a musician. Your entire life will be spent cleaning out toilets, digging sewers, the most menial and difficult of all manual labor. In the National Geographic article I made reference to a moment ago, there was a whole article about the very destructive effect of the caste system on the people who have lived under Hinduism. I have a friend who is an upper caste Hindu, and he has written a list of what Hindus believe. If you'd like a copy, you can send me a note and I'll mail it to you. But when you read through what Hindus believe, you can see why it has produced the kinds of things that are taking place in Hindu society today. The failure to use resources. The failure to use particularly animal resources. And while the view that life is sacred is important and wonderful, and we are becoming more and more ecologically sensitive to that, there is so much that indicates a failure to reduce and use all of the things that God has provided that has caused abject poverty and starvation in cultures where it has been followed. I also can send you a copy of Basic Buddhism, written by the Dalai Lama in June of 2001, in which he lists all the things that Buddhists teach. But what's interesting to me is that the Dalai Lama says in Proposition number 8, there is no God or Supreme Creator. Now, I realize there are many different sects to Buddhism. But if you look back at the history of Buddha, he really was a disillusioned Hindu prince. And the belief system has been basically a reaction to Hinduism. And the Quran. Look at the system seen in the Quran. Now, I want to emphasize here that I understand that not all Muslims believe some of the passages written in the Quran that teach violence. I have a number of Muslim friends. And they are as horrified as I am at the principles of jihad. There is a branch of Islam called the Sufis that say that all of the statements of violence are actually to be understood as intellectual struggles, not physical struggles. I wish the Muslim terrorist would take that position. Let me give you some examples. Repentance 9, beginning with verse 122. This is the ninth surah, starting with verse 122. Believers, make war on the Christians and Jews who dwell around you. Surah 8, 37 through 41, make war on the Christians and Jews until idolatry is no more and Allah's religion reigns supreme. Surah 9, verses 4 through 7, when the sacred months are over, slay the Christians and Jews. Wherever you find them, arrest them, besiege them, and lie in ambush everywhere for them. Now, as I said a moment ago, I have Muslim friends who say, no, that's not to be taken physically, that's to be understood in the context of debate. But that certainly is not the way the terrorists have interpreted it. It's certainly not the way that bin Laden interpreted it before he was killed. And as a matter of fact, Muhammad's history is that he was a great military leader, a military genius. And much of what he did in establishing the Muslim faith involved the principles of militarism. I think it's very difficult to compare the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew 5, 6, and 7 with these passages and not realize the difference between the teachings of Jesus and the teachings of Muhammad. There are other teachings that reflect the violence of this religious system. I have a friend who tells the story of being in Turkey one time, and he was shopping in a bazaar for his wife, and there was a little boy in there about 9, 10 years old who was shoplifting. And my friend's an American. He really didn't want to get involved, was afraid that he would be misunderstood. And he was trying to decide what to do because the little boy was moving towards the door of the tent. But as it turned out, he didn't have to worry because the proprietor of the place had seen what was happening. And he came over and grabbed this young man and started hollering things in Arabic. And pretty soon, a dozen other men were there holding this little boy as the kid screamed and thrashed and tried to get away. And they dragged this child out in front of the tent. They put his hands across the log and they amputated his hand on the spot. When the Taliban were in control of Kabul in the athletic stadium on Friday nights, people would be dragged in who had been caught stealing and their hands were amputated. Women sometimes had their heads cut off for being caught in an adulterous situation. And that's not a capricious act. In Surah 5, beginning with verse 37, it says, "As for the man or woman who is guilty of theft, cut off their hands, punish them for their crimes." As a matter of fact, the whole view of women is very negative in the Quran. In Surah 33, beginning with verse 51, "You may put off any of your wives you please and take to bed any of them you please." There are teachings in the Quran that are very, very difficult for civilized people to accept because they are brutal, they are violent, they are sexist. And I think it's important to realize that it's very difficult to interpret these things in any other way. Let me suggest something. If you doubt this, if you'll let me know, I'll be glad to send you a list of these passages. Get a copy of the Quran. Read it for yourself. Look at the context. See how you interpret what it said. When I was an atheist and had realized that science was pushing me strongly to believe in God, I got a copy of every great religious book I could find. I got a copy of the Quran, the Vedas, the sayings of Buddha, the writings of Baha'u'llah. I read them. I studied them. I looked up original words. And one of the things that happened to me was that I saw where these systems took people. Jesus said in Matthew 7, verse 16, "You shall know them by their fruits." And the question is, what has been the fruit of these systems? Go to the Hindu, go to the Buddhist, and ask them, what is the relationship between man and God? You know what they'll tell you? They'll tell you it's up to man to reach God. It's up to man to achieve nirvana or Brahman or whatever the stated goal is. And if man doesn't reach God based upon his own strength, based upon his own merit, then man is recycled, reincarnation, brought back to try again and again and again until man makes it on his own strength. You remember what Jesus said? "Behold, I stand at the door and knock." An interested, involved, personal God, not willing that any should be lost, but that all should inherit eternal life. That's beautiful. And it's peculiar to the relationship of man and God as portrayed in the Bible. Look at the relationship between man and nature. Do you realize in the 30 minutes that you will have been listening to me, at least in the year 2013, 400 people will have died of starvation? The numbers I see on the web indicate that we are killing, I say we are murdering, 800 people an hour on this planet because they don't have enough to eat. What's the problem? Hey folks, problem's not food. The problem is not food. If we spent the money growing food, we spend blowing each other up and preparing to blow each other up, we could feed 10 times the population the earth has right now on it. The problem is not food. One of the problems is that in many cultures, nature is considered to be God, pantheism. You're part of nature, you're part of God. Don't build a dam on the river, you'll make the river God angry. Do you remember what God said back in Genesis? Subdue the earth. Have dominion over the fish, over the fowl, over the beast of the earth. Now, he didn't say contaminate it. He didn't say pollute it. What he said was take care of the garden, dress it, and keep it. But the fact that those of us who live in the United States have enough to eat, have a place to go to stay out of the elements, is because our ancestors believed and did what God said. How can anybody that has been privileged to live in the United States of America rationally question the biblical system when everything we have came from that system? And look at the relationship between man and woman. It's kind of interesting to look at the consequences of the alternatives to God's way. Because from the very beginning, in Genesis 2 and verse 24, God says, "Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and they shall become one flesh." A special, unique relationship. In many cultures, polygamy is practiced, one man having many wives. Ladies, do you believe you could have the kind of relationship you want with that one man if you were sharing him with 25 other women? Every time I say that, somebody comes up to me and says, "Well, it's not too hot the way it is." I wouldn't touch that with a 10-foot pole. But you won't improve anything by putting 24 more wives in the picture. Gentlemen, do you believe you could have the kind of relationship you want with that one woman if you're sharing her with 8 or 9 other men? There are religious systems, there are cultures that teach polyandry, one wife with many husbands, mostly as a matter of birth control. But Jesus stated it as the ideal, as what God intended from the beginning, one man, one wife, for life. That's beautiful. And it's peculiar to the teachings of the Bible. It builds a relationship, it provides a unity, and if you're lucky enough to have the kind of marriage that I've been lucky enough to have, you won't have one doubt in the world about the wisdom in that system. The problem in our culture has been that people tend to run to the divorce court instead of going to their knees when they have a problem, and they never learn what marriage is. And if you've been married less than 10 years, you still don't know what it is. A good marriage is something you build, not something you happen into. And look at the relationship between man and God. Acts 10, verses 34 and 35, "Of the truth I perceive that God is no respecter of persons, but in every nation he that feareth him and worketh righteousness is accepted with him." Galatians 3 and verse 28, "There is neither Jew nor Greek, there is neither bond nor free, there is neither male nor female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus." Romans 2 and verse 11, "For there is no respect of persons with God." Isn't it a beautiful thing that no matter what sex you are, no matter what race you are, no matter how much money you have, no matter how much education you have, no matter even what you've done, you have as much right to talk to God on a one-to-one basis as anyone else. Isn't it a beautiful thing? We don't need a big fancy church building to worship God. Matthew 18 and verse 20 says, "For where two or three are gathered together in my name, there I am in the midst of them." We can worship God on a cornfield, in a boat. We don't need a fancy church building. 1 Corinthians 3:16, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and that God's Spirit dwells in you?" And the last point I would make in support of the biblical record is that the Christian system and God's teaching and His Word changes lives. At the end of this series of lessons, I will share why I left atheism. My life is different today than it was as an atheist, not because of any strength I have, but because the Christian system and the power of God working through the Holy Spirit changed me. And there are thousands and thousands of people that can tell a very similar story. I am not a Christian because I inherited that belief. I'm a Christian because when I realized there was a God and I looked at the evidence, I saw no other option but that Jesus is in fact the way, the truth, and the life, and that no one can come to the Father but by Him. But there are some other evidences, and we'll talk about that in the next lesson.